Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Skip Rhodes, past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Directors and your moderator for today's program. Today's program is part of the Future of Work series sponsored by Wells Fargo and Ernst & Young. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's special guest. Our speaker today is Chairman and Editor-in-Chief of Forbes Media. Under his leadership, the company has launched into a variety of new publications and businesses. The company's flagship publication, Forbes, is the nation's leading business magazine with a circulation of more than 900,000. Forbes combined with Forbes Asia and the company's licensee editions together reach a worldwide audience of more than 6 million readers. Our speaker writes editorials for each issue of Forbes magazine under the heading of Fact and Comment. A widely respected economic prognosticator, he is the only writer to have won the highly prestigious Crystal Owl Award 4 times. The award is given to the financial journalist whose economic forecasts for the coming year proved most accurate. In both 1996 and 2000, he campaigned for the Republican nomination for the presidency. Key to his platform were a flat tax, medical savings accounts, a new Social Security system for working Americans, parental choice of schools for their children, term limits, and a strong national defense. He continues to energetically promote this agenda. As one of the nation's most prominent economic forecasters, he will present an outlook for job and business as we head towards the November election. The title of his presentation to us today is Simple Ways to Get the U.S. Economy Growing Again. Please give a warm Commonwealth Club introduction and hand to our speaker, Steve Forbes. Mr. Forbes.
Well, thank you very much, Skip, for those very kind words. Thank you for being here today. For a speaker, it is always good to speak after a meal. You're contented, maybe, and there's less food on the table to misdirect if you don't like what you are hearing. But it is a great honor to be here. And as Skip indicated, I'm going to make a few observations today about our economy, where it's at, where it's going, why it hasn't really picked up steam again, and what that means for the world. And then I'd also like to make a few observations about free markets and government, which I think is going to have a critical impact on the future of this country and, indeed, the global economy. In terms of the economy, yes, we are growing this year, but we're like a car on an open highway going about 30 miles an hour instead of 70, 75 miles an hour. Never before have we had such a weak recovery from a sharp downturn, and that leads to the basic question, why? What are the things that are standing in the way? The first barrier that is slowing us down, headwind that is slowing us down, and I have to warn you in advance, is the most boring subject in the world, monetary policy. I see eyelids getting heavy already. You say monetary policy, exchange rates, interest rates, Ben Bernanke, and people are falling asleep, especially after a nice meal. And just to give you as a reward for what you're about to undergo, give you a travel tip. If you ever find yourself in an airplane, in coach, middle seat, on the runway, watching your life pass away, and you want a little bit of elbow room with your seatmates, start talking about monetary policy and you'll have all the room you want. Or if any of you are single or if friends are single, on a bad date, want out, talk about monetary policy and you'll never see that person again. But if you think of monetary policy, just to get down to its essence, as you would an automobile, you know, you can have a magnificent vehicle, but if you don't have sufficient fuel, you stall. Too much fuel, you flood the engine. right amount, you have a chance to move ahead. The same is true of monetary policy. You can have an economy with basic strengths, but if you don't supply enough money to meet the organic needs of the marketplace, you're going to stall the thing. You print too much money, you get the economic equivalent of flooding the engine. Right amount, you have a chance to move ahead. And the same, this is what's happening in the world today. Long story short, the Federal Reserve has been on a money binge since the early part of the last decade. And this is something that most political authorities don't understand, precisely because it's so inhibiting, it's so boring, but it undermined the presidency of George Bush, the weak dollar, and it's undermined the presidency, along with some other things, of President Obama. It undermined Nixon. He did a lot of other things, but this was a contributing factor, the great inflation. And it undermined Carter, and none of those individuals fully appreciate what hit them, even to this day. But to totally bore you, money is simply a means of doing transactions with each other. That's all it is. It makes it easy to do transactions. Now, in the old days, we had barter. So if I sold an ad in Forbes 3,000 years ago, how would I get paid? Perhaps with a herd of goats. And then let's say I wanted to buy iPads for our writers. So I go to the Apple store 3,000 years ago with my goats, and the store says, well, we want sheep. So now I've got to go out and find somebody to exchange my goats for sheep. Perhaps I have to hire a sheep herder to make sure the wolves don't eat them. And the sheep herder wants to be paid in wine. I have red wine. He wants white wine. It just becomes very cumbersome and clumsy. You don't get many transactions done. Money just makes it infinitely easier, whether it's coins, pieces of paper, blips in a computer. You do it, and you decide what you get in exchange in the transaction. So money in that sense is fixed in value. It's like weights and measures. When you go buy a pound of something, you assume it's 16 ounces, not 13 ounces, 10 ounces, or 18 ounces. It doesn't fluctuate each day. It stays the same. You travel a mile. It's 5,280 feet, not 4,000 feet, not 7,000 feet. You contract to build a house. Someday we'll do that again. Let's say for 2,500 square feet. You assume it's 12 inches in a foot, not 8 inches or 20 inches. You assume it's fixed. The same is true. Now, imagine, just to hammer this home, imagine if the government did to the hour what it does to the dollar. So you assume 60 minutes in an hour. Imagine if they floated the clock. So you have 60 minutes in an hour one day, 80 minutes the next, 20 minutes the day after. You'd soon have to have hedges, derivatives, futures to figure out how many hours you're working. So you go hire somebody for 15, 20 bucks an hour to do a job. Now, is that a California hour? Is it an Arizona hour, Bangladesh hour, Japanese hour? You'd soon have to have handhelds with cross-hour rates, and or you want to bake a cake. It says bake the batter for 45 minutes. Now you have to, is that a San Francisco minute, a Nevada minute? Just makes life infinitely complicated. So when you have a cheapening of the dollar, what it does is profoundly undermine commerce in ways we don't even realize. Keynes was right when he said not one in a million realize how destructive this thing is. It misdirects capital. When suddenly you can't trust the value of money, where does money go? It goes into hard assets. You saw it in the 70s. None of you are old enough to remember the 70s. But in the 70s, you saw oil suddenly go from $3 a barrel to $40 a barrel. And people are wondering, is it greedy oil companies? What's happening here? It's nefarious Arabs, whatever, whatever. And when inflation was conquered by Reagan, President Reagan, and then Fed Chairman Paul Volcker, what happened to the price of oil? It crashed from $40 down to $10, finally stabilized around an average of $20, $25. You also see it in housing. You had a housing, artificial housing boom in the 70s. You had one on steroids this time. The blunt truth is, in terms of the housing bubble and then bust, you never could have had a bubble of that size, even with Fannie and Freddie and everything else, the Fed hadn't printed the money to finance it. Could not have happened. And yet the Fed doesn't get the blame. Everyone else gets the blame. I mentioned commodities. You see it again. Oil averaged between the mid-80s to the early part of the last decade, about $21.50 a barrel. Now what is it today? 97, 100, pick a number. You also see it in the financial sector, especially in the global economy you have today. We have intricate supply chains around the world. If you have uncertain commodities everywhere, you have volatility more than normal, volatility in currencies more than normal, interest rates in different countries going every which way, hardly any relation. What happens? You get exotic instruments to try to cope with it, which leads to speculation, trading opportunities, but also a complexity that requires brain power. So enormous brain power is misdirected to the financial sector to deal with this kind of craziness. And again, nobody understands the process. See it in farmland, which has more than doubled in the last 10 years. And this gets to a very important point. When the dollar is being trashed, you can't trust prices anymore. I mentioned the price of oil, price of gasoline. How much of that is genuine supply and demand? How much of that is inflation or anticipation of inflation and speculation, hoarding, because you figure if you better buy now because it's going to get more expensive nominally in the future? You can't trust the price anymore. You see it, too, in the capital markets. Do any of you really believe that in a normal market, the U.S. government today could sell 10-year bonds at 1.5% interest or 30-year bonds at 2.5% interest? Only the Brits did that in history, and that was back in the 1800s when the pound was seen as good as gold. So what happens is you can't trust the prices of credit anymore. So what that means is the private sector gets starved of credit even though there's a lot of liquidity out there. Government gets its money, that's easy. Big business gets its money, that's easy. But small and medium-sized businesses, very uncertain because you don't know what the real price of money is. So it's very, very disruptive. And what it is, in essence, is a form of government coercion. When the government trashes the value of your money, what it means is it takes asset away from you or gives a windfall to commodities or the financial sector. Without legislation, without any discussion, it's done arbitrarily, which ultimately undermines social trust. And that's why you have this feeling out there that the traditional link between effort and reward is being undermined. You see it in the sovereign debt crisis in Europe. Could you have had the borrowing binges there if you had sound money, stable money in value? No. It's like the government deciding, just hammer home this point, then we'll get on to the other things. It's like government deciding that to stimulate the economy, getting back to our clock, it'll increase the number of minutes in an hour from 60 to 70, but not tell anyone. So suddenly in that way, people will work longer at the same pay. That'll be a great boost to productivity. Increased profits help boost the economy. Well, suddenly you notice the day is longer than you anticipated. And then unions finally get onto it and say, well, instead of 70 minutes, it should be a 50-minute hour. And the thing just breaks down. So watch the price of gold. Watch those commodities. They'll tell you more than any statement from the Fed of what markets anticipate. It is extremely disruptive. You're not going to get a growing economy on a sustainable basis if you can't trust weights and measures. You can't trust the value of the dollar. What's this lead to ultimately? I'll say something that sounds outlandish, but it'll happen, I think, in 5 years. I say 5 years because most of you will forget what I said. So if I'm right, we'll just let it go in the ether. And if I'm wrong, we'll just let it go in the ether. And if I'm right, I'll remind you of it 5 years from now. But ultimately, I think what you're going to see is something that sounds outlandish today, but actually isn't so outlandish, and that is the dollar will be relinked to GOLD. Why? Because no other commodity keeps its intrinsic value better than gold. Not perfect, but it's like the Polaris, best thing we got. If you have anything better, let us know, because so far they haven't discovered it in the capitals. What are the other barriers out there? There are more traditional ones. If you understand that wealth is created by you doing transactions with each other, that's how money is simply the facilitator of it, you doing real things, then you realize what government spending does. Spending money does not come manna from heaven. It comes from you, either through taxation or borrowing or printing of money, which is another form of taxation. So the central government takes in resources one way or the other, puts it through the political sausage factory, sprays it out, and that's supposed to be stimulus. Japan's been doing this since the early 90s, and they've been dead in the water. We tried it in the 1930s. It did not work. We're trying it again today. It manifestly does not work. It takes resources from you, puts it in the political sausage factory. That's the thing to keep in mind. It just doesn't appear magically. Oh, a gold ship appeared. Yay, hooray. So That is a huge a drain on the economy. Another one, of course, is taxation. The thing to keep in mind on taxation is it just isn't about taking in revenue to meet the needs, perceived needs of big government. It's also a price and a burden. The tax on income is the price you pay for working. Tax on capital gains, the price you pay for taking risks that work out. Tax on profit, the price you pay for being successful. And the proposition is a very simple one, but it's amazing how often it's ignored. When you lower the price of good things, like productive work, risk-taking, success, you'll get more of them. Raise the price, you'll get less of them. So if you understand that money, when you have an instability, huge misallocation of time, resources, arbitrary rewards, arbitrary punishments. Understand that spending means taking resources from you. Understand that taxation is a price and a burden. Becomes clear where we've gone wrong in recent years. We should be simplifying the tax code. I believe in the flat tax. You know, the tax code today is 9 million words and rising. That compares to the Bible, which took centuries to put together. That's only 773,000 words. The Constitution, with the amendments, a little over 7,000 words. Federal income tax code and all the attendant rules and regulations, 9 million words and rising, and no one knows what's in it. IRS doesn't know. You don't know. Tax collectors don't know. Tax lawyers really don't know. They know pieces of it, maybe. You don't have to go to the Amazon to find exotic creatures. They're crawling around this code. It's been amended 14,000 times, changed 14,000 times since the mid-1980s. So the IRS calculates that last year we spent 6.5 billion hours filling out tax forms. For what purpose? It's the biggest source of corruption in Washington. Half the lobbying revolves around the tax code, trying to get an advantage or protect yourself or whatever. Brings out the worst in us each year as we go through this horrendous exercise. So I believe we should just junk the thing and start all over again with a single rate, generous exemptions for adults and for kids, family of four, no tax in your first $46,000 of income, federal income tax. Above that, only 17 cents on the dollar, no tax on savings, and I believe it should be no death taxes. You should be allowed to leave the world unmolested by the IRS. And do the same thing on the business side. Lower the rate to 17, no more depreciation schedules. You make a capital investment and write it off in the year in which you make it. If you have a loss, carry it forward. Make it simple so the brains can focus on real things to increase the wealth of the nation. And then regulation. Regulation, we all hear about it, but the government calculates it costs us $1.75 trillion a year. And it's from big and small things. We all know about ethanol now causing hunger around the world, as almost 40% of the corn we grow goes into something that now is even environmentally bad, but it's got political power behind it, so it is done. The FDA, Food and Drug Administration, standing in the way of development of antibiotics. Why they're doing this, I don't know. But, you know, the threat when you go to a hospital is it's not just what you go in for, but getting an infection. And so we need new antibiotics. But drug companies now won't make the investment because they know the FDA is not going to approve the thing. They're going to drag it out, change the goalposts. And let me just close on this in terms of headwinds because this leads into health care. And that is, ask yourself, why do we have a health care crisis? And the answer is, well, people like me are getting older. We want more health care, which means it gets more expensive. We can't afford it. We got to find a way to ration the stuff. But think of it. Why is the demand for health care considered a crisis? When in any other part of the economy, people want more of something, entrepreneurs and free markets will provide it, find a way to do it in ever more innovative, cheaper ways. You want more automobiles or trucks, a lot of manufacturers will be there, glad to help you out. You want more apps, a lot of writers, glad to help you out. So what's with health care? Why is the health care demand seen as a disaster instead of a fantastic opportunity? The answer is we don't have real free markets in healthcare. We have pieces of it, which is why we still produce more new medicines and medical devices than the rest of the world. But it's a convoluted market, dominated more and more distorted by government. It wasn't designed that way, but that's the way the thing has evolved. And the proof of it is, because we've grown up with it, we don't realize how crazy it is. If you go to a doctor, clinic, or hospital, and you ask in advance what it's going to cost, you're going to get a very strange look. It means one of two things. Either you're uninsured, or you're a lunatic. I mean, why would you want to know what it costs? What's it to you? You know, can you imagine? You're having some food here. Imagine going to a restaurant, ordering a nice bottle of wine, saying, I don't care what it costs, let Medicare or Blue Shield or Aetna or somebody else worry about it, sort it out. System goes haywire, so you don't get the normal kind of productivity and constant innovation that you see everywhere else, where truly you get more for less and things you didn't even realize you needed before. So this gets to then something, and I just wrote a book on it, co-authored it, called Freedom Manifesto. I'll hold it up so I can earn my $5 advance. Why free markets are moral and big government isn't. And what it gets to is something that is, I think, critically important as we go in the future. I've been discussing policy, monetary policy, taxes, tax policy, regulatory policy, how we get more free markets in healthcare. By the way, one of the biggest things in healthcare, if you want to get more free markets, is allow nationwide shopping for health insurance. I live in New Jersey. We have stupid regulations. I can get a perfectly good policy in neighboring Pennsylvania at half the price I do in New Jersey. It's illegal for me to buy it, even though I can buy a car in Pennsylvania or a house or a candy bar, can't buy the insurance. Have nationwide shopping. Have hundreds of companies compete for it. Equalized tax treatment. If businesses get a deduction, why shouldn't you as an individual if you go out in the marketplace? Tort reform and the like, positive things. You get more market orientation. And just one closing thing on health care, then I'll get to free markets. In terms of going forward, why in the world can't we do in health care what we do with food? Food's more basic than health care. No food, no nothing. Imagine if government took over agriculture in this country. What would happen? We'd have no more obesity. We'd all be starving. And so we allow agriculture, produce the food, companies process the food, trucks and others deliver the food, grocery stores, clubs, supermarkets, others sell the food. And if people have a problem getting the food, we have everything from food banks to food stamps to deal with it. Why in the world can't we do the same thing in healthcare? Have real free markets, have effective safety nets so we get the best of innovation and productivity and not have this strange thing where demand is seen as a problem, not an opportunity. And in terms of free markets, I want to close with this point. Unfortunately, government, I'm talking about big government, not government. James Madison was right, the father of our Constitution. We need government. He said if we were angels, we would not need government. We'd not need laws. Manifestly, we are not angels. Maybe grandkids are, at least to a certain age. But after that, it's pretty problematical. So you do need government. But you don't need massive big government. And the reason government gets bigger and bigger is because it occupies the high moral ground. Government portrays itself as compassionate, caring, enforcer of fairness. So if you come out against a government program, you get the response, you're against children? What do you have against education? What do you have against health care for the elderly? And so you immediately go on defense. And markets are seen as amoral, uncaring, cruel, driven by greed. You know, in Hollywood, the villains are usually business people. And there have been studies that show that in Hollywood, business people kill more people than serial killers do in the movies. Always, it's time to re-examine that. Markets are moral, free markets. Now, not perfect because human beings are not perfect, but markets are moral because you succeed by meeting the needs and wants of other people. Even if you have that lust for money, you don't get it unless you provide something that somebody else wants. It is about transactions. Adam Smith famously described, you go to the restaurant, the butcher and the baker, give you food, you give money in return. You always get something in return. Greed means taking something that doesn't belong to you. Now, some transactions are more fun than others. Buying a handbag, fun, at least until you get the bill. Buying a new sports car, same thing. No fun paying the electricity bill. No fun paying the rent. But you do get something in return. And it sort of amuses me, human nature being what it is. Those who complain about electricity rates then go out and spend $200 on a pair of jeans. Look like they came from a dumpster, but you know that's human nature. But big government meets its own needs. It's payback to political constituencies. So markets are about transactions, and they bring about cooperation. You know, you may not love your neighbor, but you sure want to sell to your neighbor. And we take it for granted, when you start a business in this country, we take it for granted that you want to get the best people to make the thing work. That is fairly new in human affairs. It's only in fairly recent times in the scope of human history that people could get beyond immediate family and trust somebody, get beyond the immediate community, ethnic group. Commerce helps break those barriers down without us really realizing it. Again, you don't have to love somebody else, but you want to cooperate because you have a shared purpose of getting something done. So what free markets do is create resources. You take oil, which is supposed to be a natural resource. What is oil? In and of itself, it's glop, gooey stuff. Can't eat it, drink it, can't feed it to camels. What makes it something we can't live without for now? Human ingenuity. Scarcity into abundance. Cell phones. You've seen the picture of cell phones 30 years ago. Big as a shoebox. 30-minute battery life, $3,995. Today, poorest of the poor can get cell phones, 5 billion around the world. Everywhere. They do everything now. Kenya, use it for banking. Use it for health care. Do everything now except comb your hair or grow your hair. It's amazing. And yet, so where government gets involved, you get scarcity, like we're having in health care. Where you allow free markets with sensible rules of the road, you get abundance and creativity. You see it in Apple versus Solyndra, which is meritocracy versus cronyism. Steve Jobs famously said he doesn't do marketing surveys, didn't do marketing surveys when he's alive, because he said people don't know what they want until we show them. That's the essence of entrepreneurship, putting something out there. People might have rejected the iPad, but they turned out to love it. And we all had a higher standard of living because of it. Whereas with the Solyndras, it's cronyism. You have a political in, you get the money. You keep the bureaucrats happy, you get the money. Not right. So the bottom line in all of this is, what kind of nation do we want? Do we want, with free markets, meeting the basic needs of people, but having free markets create, turning scarcity into abundance, create things we never even thought we had to have, and then suddenly we can't live without them? That's the genius of it. That's the genius of it. And Henry Adams, let me just close by quoting Henry Adams. He wrote The Education of Henry Adams, a famous book that they used to read in colleges and high schools. And he talked about The Education of Henry Adams. He talked about what happened when he went to the Paris Exposition in 1900 and saw the 40-foot dynamo, which was then the symbol of great industrial productivity. And he marveled at how much new things had been created in the previous 100 years. And he said he began to feel the 40-foot dynamos as a moral force. This is Henry Adams saying, much as the early Christians felt the cross. Now, that's a little over the top, dynamo cross, but you got the sense of awe at the limitless opportunities, as he put it, of what human ingenuity in a proper environment can create. That kind of awe we have to restore and get back again, limitless opportunities. That's where we should be going. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Forbes. We have a whole raft of questions here, so let's start with this one. What is the status of the flat tax proposal? Is it on the table in any major Republican circles?
The flat tax, radical tax simplification, is out there. Paul Ryan had a proposal of two rates. I had one, but he has two. I'll take two. 10% on your first 100,000, 25% above 100,000, removing most of the clutter of the code. And I'll take that. Romney is not quite there yet. He has a 20% across the board cut in tax rates across the board, decluttering some of the code. So I hope with Ryan's influence, they go for all of it, because if you try to declutter the code, start to sweep out the garbage in the code, and some of it's done with the best of intentions, but it just multiplies. You got to do almost everything. because otherwise, the people who are under attack will all coalesce together with the others who even aren't under attack, saying, well, if they're going to get them, eventually they're going to get me. You've got to do it all at once. And the other thing you have to do, and there's one thing I hope to persuade these two of it ultimately, is you have to give people at least initially a choice. Because when you radically simplify the tax code, a lot of people just focus on what they lose, not what they gain. And so you got to give people the relief, oh, okay, if I don't like this thing, I can stay with the disastrous old one. I love to punish myself. I have low self-esteem, so I want to go through this horror every year. If you want to, go right ahead. Hong Kong has a variation of that. They have a little progressive system. They also have a single flat rate. You choose each year which one you want. And so that just lowers the temperature. Oh, I'm not going to lose it. If you want that stuff, go ahead. Keep the old. So it's moving in that direction. Even some of you may be familiar with something called Simpson-Bowles. That was a commission appointed by President Obama to deal with the deficit. It, like most things, went nowhere, but it's sort of lingered on, the idea. One of the things they proposed was decluttering the tax code somewhat, not nearly enough, but reducing tax rates across the board. The Democrats there, a lot of them signed on to that idea. Not again, not as far as I would like, but so the idea is gaining currency, you might say. The idea we need simplicity so you can focus the brain on real things and not just go through this horror and waste 7 billion hours a year that even if you did nothing would be better than the angst you do and, you know, the poor dog has to live around you to go through that. No. So it is beginning to happen. By the way, 25 countries around the world have enacted the flat tax.
As a follow-up to your flat tax explanation, this writer says, I support the flat tax, but thought there was not enough discussion about it in the media. What are some other ways to increase real discussion of your ideas other than making many speeches?
This is where the modern world of technology is wonderful. Do it online. Get friends together. Start talking about it, badgering your representatives, badgering your candidates. Where do you stand on this? It's one reason why in this book we have a Facebook page. We have an online page called freedommanifesto.us to encourage that kind of community and discussion. And I think it's still underestimated, even though people know this is a big thing, people underestimate the power that comes from that kind of talking to one another and interacting with one another. Just a sideways, just one little thing. In the media business, which has been turned upside down 50 times like a pretzel and contorted because of the web, one of the things that happens, a big change, is content creation. Just a few years ago in my business, we came out with 26 issues a year of Forbes. We had about 50 good articles in each issue, 1,400 articles a year. Today, online, Forbes.com, where we now have 30 million unique visitors a month, we have about 900 contracted contributors outside of the Forbes editorial staff contributing content. We now do about 120,000 articles a year, almost a magazine a day, almost. And so in terms of the world in which we're living in, don't underestimate the value of that kind of communication. So reach out and start creating electronic pressure groups.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is Steve Forbes, chairman of Forbes Media, who is discussing how to improve the U.S. economy. Another question, Mr. Forbes. Are there more financial shoes to drop in Europe that could badly impact or even cripple the U.S. economy?
I'm an optimist, but unfortunately the Europeans are just behaving in ways that just have you shaking your head. And the answer is yes, they are on their way to really messing things up. And what is happening in Europe, amazingly, in this day and age, is they're making the same mistakes they made in the early 1930s. Thankfully, unlike the early 30s, we still have an international trading system of capital and goods and services flowing around the world. In the early 30s, we blew that up. But what you see in Europe today is, for all the talk of austerity, Most governments are still spending more than they did 2 or 3 years ago. Greece this year is spending more than it did last year. Where the burden is falling is on the private sector. More taxes are falling on the private sector. More taxes are falling on consumers and producers. And so as a result, they're in a death spiral. They have to meet budget deficit projections. So they pile on more taxes, which makes the economy slower and drives the economy down. So the revenues are short. And they go through the process again. And so you get this death spiral. In the early 30s, when the Depression started after we blew up the trading system, how did Britain respond? It increased income taxes in 1930, increased them again in 1931. The U.S., other countries did the same thing. In 1932, we put in a tax increase that raised the top income tax rate from 25% to 63%. We had numerous excise taxes, including a stamp tax on checks. Every time you wrote a check, you had to pay a tax to the government. And so, no surprise, the economy went straight down. And so what do we find unfolding today? Spain just raised the top income tax rate to 52%. Italy wants to raise the value-added tax yet again, put new taxes on homeowners. Greece just piling on taxes. Japan, which gets outside of immediately Europe, but they're doing this to a fairly well. Japan, stagnant Japan, how are they responding? Doubling their national sales tax from 5 to 10%, raising the top income tax rate to 55%, raising inheritance taxes, raising payroll taxes, raising capital gains taxes. This is a definition of insanity. They should be going in the opposite direction to make it viable for the private sector to exist. In Europe, they refuse. The Italians, Spanish refuse to make internal structural changes in terms of labor laws, in terms of ease of starting a business. Try starting a legal business in Italy. Very, very complicated. And whereas by contrast in New Zealand, you just go online, done in an instant. New Zealand's doing okay, thank you very much. So they're not doing the things they need to do to get their economies back on the feet. They're crushing the private sector, and the Germans aren't much better. They're encouraging them to do this kind of nonsense. So it's like the early 30s, and thankfully we don't have bad movements of that nature of the early 30s, but I guarantee you bad things are going to happen politically if that kind of nonsense continues, and that's why I hope after November we get on a path where we're doing positive things, because if we get things right, not to be chauvinistic, but it's absolutely true, the rest of the world gets things right. You saw it in the 30s. If we don't get it right, it all goes kablooey. Same thing in the 70s. Whereas in the early 80s, when Reagan put in massive income tax rate cuts, do you realize within 10 or 15 years, 50 countries around the world did the same thing to varying degrees? So you get things right, people see success, it sets the political environment where you get a few things right. And in Europe, even though the Spanish, the French, putting in a 75% income tax rate, are going crazy things. Other countries are resisting it. Poland, massive privatization program. Poland doing nicely. Sweden, once a paradise for tax raisers, been cutting tax rates, doing very nicely. Small countries like Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Albania doing the right things. I was in Estonia recently. We launched a magazine there, partnership licensing agreement. In Estonia, which has a flat tax, you know, just to put things in perspective, in this country, the government debt is now equivalent to 100% of GDP. Greece, 170%. Japan, 200% of GDP. Little Estonia, which, by the way, has become a high-tech center. Skype came out of Estonia. They have free Wi-Fi. They're really into this stuff. 6% of GDP. So a handful of countries there get it, but the big ones, particularly in Western Europe, don't. And so, yes, they could throw this off a cliff. So the sooner we get positive examples out there, the better, because Japan and Western Europe are, you know, it's horrifying what they're doing.
Could you comment on recent articles in the media that the middle class has either disappeared or is at least declining, and what that means to the U.S. economy?
Well, it's highly abnormal for middle class either not to be expanding in this country in terms of numbers as people work their way up, especially if you're an immigrant, you come with nothing. When the generation, you're really starting to get into it, and your kids even more, and or moving up to upper middle class. So this gets to that boring subject I brought up earlier. When you start trashing money, who is hurt the most? Wage earners, because you have least protection in terms of the ravages of what the Fed does. And so it's no coincidence. You had the same phenomenon in the 70s and early 80s before we made reforms. People felt they weren't able to get ahead anymore. I remember hearing back then, oh, well, our kids will not have this, you know, rising standard of living that we enjoyed. Now we're hearing that, I hear that same vocabulary again today. When you undermine a currency, you hurt people's ability to get ahead. And so that's the abnormal. They call it new normal, but it is abnormal. So get the money right. Get the money right so you can trust it again, stable value, like 60 minutes in an hour, and a few of these other things going. That'll reverse itself very quickly. People want to trade with one another. People, a lot of entrepreneurial activity, and just to end on a little nice note on that, in terms of entrepreneurial activity, several months ago we did a cover story in Forbes and amplified it online on kids in college running businesses that have revenues between $100,000 and $500,000 a year. It was moderated by Michael Dell. And so there is this entrepreneurial energy, especially in this high-tech age. People are accustomed to being masters or mistresses of their own fate, or like to be, if you have the right environment. And by the way, I shouldn't say this because we all love education, but Michael Dell, when he was in college, he did not want to go to college. His parents forced him. And in his freshman year, when he got to University of Texas, he just went and started selling computers, making them and selling them. And one day, the story goes, his parents called and said, "We're going to visit you, Michael." Now, normally for a kid, that means either getting the boyfriend or girlfriend out of the room, doing 3 months' worth of laundry, getting a fumigator in and things like that. With the case of Michael Dell, the story goes, it was trying to find a place to hide his computer inventory that he kept in his room. And so he found a place to hide it. His parents come and look around and say, "Michael, something's not right here." And he says, "What?" The parents said, "There are no textbooks." Dell said, "Oh, gosh, I forgot to buy them." So sometimes in early age you feel that itch.
Following on that story, this questioner says, having an educated public is the long-term answer to our economic power. How would you address the student debt crisis? We need educated young people, not in-debt young people. Would you structure financing education differently?
Well, this gets to something that, thankfully, there are studies that are undergirding this. But, again, in education, why in the world is education going up far faster than even health care? Last 12 years, prices have gone up 100%, health care 220%, tuition's about 400%. Why is this happening? One of the reasons it's happening is this: government help for tuitions, whether it's Pell Grants or guaranteed loans. What that means is when the money is in the parents' hands before they shovel it over, the kids' hands before they shovel over to the university, university spends the money. To be blunt about it, you look at most of these institutions, look at their administrative costs, real administrative costs, they try to hide this, goes up faster than classroom instruction. If you want your kids to be rude, have them ask, how many hours does a professor now spend in the classroom versus 20 years ago or 30 years ago? So it bloats, and there's a reaction to it. Until very recently, institutions all tried to raise prices. If Harvard's charging $50,000, you have to charge $50,000 to show that you're not providing an inferior education. You know, lower price must mean, there's junk there. That's going to change profoundly. One, high tech means you have access to teachers and professors all around the world. You don't need to have them physically there. Robert Shiller, who is a famous finance professor at Yale, Shiller, Case-Shiller Index and Housing, he decided to put one of his courses online for free. 160,000 people plugged in on it. Getting a good algebra course, $69. So you don't need the physical interaction the way you did before. The other thing that's going to happen, I think, in education, no more one size fits all, is ask ourselves, why does it take 4 years or 6 years or 10 years to get an undergraduate degree? Well, we take 3 months off in the summer. What if you take 5 weeks off and do this in 3 years, which you could do? Advanced degree, 4, 4.5 instead of 6, 7, or 8. So you're going to see these pressures, and parents are now asking in a way they never would have dared do before, what are we getting with the resources we are spending? What are you getting that's going to make you more productive when you go out in this world? And it doesn't mean you become a mechanic or, become a trade school. It means really focusing on courses that really develop the mind and not so many gut courses that some of us coasted by on. And that's important. There's a fellow named Norman Borlaug, who won the Nobel Prize. He created the Green Revolution, which literally saved tens of millions of lives in countries like India and elsewhere, massively increased crop outputs. And he majored, I think it was in chemistry when he was in college, and he said when he started to see these great breakthroughs that he's bringing about, he suddenly realized it's not enough to have technical expertise. He said, I was drawing on subjects I never thought I'd have to draw on, like economics and politics. But he was urging students, have that broad-based education as well as focusing, because you never know what life is going to do to you or open up to you, and you're going to have to draw on resources. And thanks to high tech, you can continue the education. You need a course online from somebody very good. So bottom line on it, this cannot continue, where you get out a degree, dubious prospects for a job, huge amounts of debt. You wonder what you actually got for the $100,000, $200,000 that you plunked down. That's going to change. People are realizing this cannot continue, and it won't.
Mr. Forbes, this questioner says, we've had the dot-com bubble, the housing bubble, and now the Obama debt bubble. Should we be as concerned about the debt bubble as the pundits are touting?
The answer about bubbles, especially artificially created bubbles, is yes, they do a lot of harm. And you have to make the distinction, and I'm not running for anything so I can do this, because otherwise it'd be portrayed as favoring bubbles. And it's one thing when something new comes along and everyone jumps into it because they all see an opportunity. I'm going to remember the early 80s when PCs first came along. Everyone knew this was big, and so everyone jumped into it. So you had companies like Atari and Commodore and others. Then you had the inevitable shakeout, and you saw it in automobiles. We had, over 300 major manufacturers in this country. So whenever something new comes along, everyone jumps into it. That's not a real bubble. That's capital jumps in, sees an opportunity, shakes out, and people come in and figure out who the marketplace determined who does it best. And so in terms of bubbles, what we saw in the late 90s, part of it was natural. But it was artificially inflated. And this, again, is something they don't understand almost anywhere. Artificially inflated by the Fed. Why? Because inadvertently, the Fed tightened up in the late 90s. The U.S. had cut its capital gains tax, this under Bill Clinton, and did some other pro-growth things. So suddenly, we became a magnet. People wanted dollars again. And so you had a dollar shortage. And so what happened? Investment in traditional areas like manufacturing, steelmaking, agriculture suffered a deflation. And hot areas like high tech, you got a real bubble effect, not just the normal one, but tens of billions flowing in that normally wouldn't have flowed in if you'd had a stable currency. And so it was grossly inflated. Now, you look at the housing bubble. That became about because the Fed was going in the opposite direction, printing too much money. So you got the bubble there, just as you got it for a while in oil. May still be there today. The debt bubble, when you artificially lower the price of credit and artificially decrease the supply of government bonds, as the Fed is doing, guess what happens? It becomes very easy for the government to finance its debts. Very easy at a very low price. And the insanity is the government's taken on huge amounts of debt and at shorter maturity rates. They should be going long, 50 years, 100 years, because when rates go up, boy, the cost of financing that debt is going to mushroom. It's about a little over $200 billion a year. Could easily go to $600 or $800 billion in a flash of an eyelid. And so, yes, it is a bubble to worry about. And again, that gets to the quicker we get a stable dollar, the less disruptive bubbles we're going to have. And have normal bubbles where you get the shakeout. Too bad for the investors, but that's life. Instead of something that shakes the economy to its very core.
Next question. A vocal element of the Republican Party wants to significantly curtail or end the powers and independence of the Fed. What are your views on that?
In terms of the Fed, one thing just to put in perspective, the Fed was not created by the Constitution. The Fed and its friends like to portray it as an independent branch of government. No, it isn't. It's a government agency created by an act of Congress in 1913. So it's not like the Supreme Court or a separate branch of government. Let's make that clear. So accountability to Congress, yes. You don't want Congress running the Fed. You don't want Congress running much of anything. But there should be accountability. There's more accountability to Congress from intelligence agencies than from the Fed, which is nuts. And it's because, again, it's this, complicated subject. Oh, the priests, the wizards and all that. So they tend to kind of leave it alone. And yes, there should be accountability, but there also should be an understanding of what central banking is about. The Fed should be only doing two things: stable dollar and then dealing with panics, which happen from time to time. And the British showed us back in the 1860s how you deal with a panic when people suddenly want cash because they think the world's coming to an end or something, as we saw in 2008. You will lend to banks, open up the printing presses, but you charge punitive rates above the market rate. So you have collateral, you can get the cash, but you as a banking institution have every incentive to pay it back as soon as possible. But you need a temporary cash because of forces beyond your control, you do it. Brits did this in the 1860s, had no banking failures for 140 years. So that's what the Fed should do here. Deal with a crisis, then pull out. Instead, it now tries to guide the economy. It says, well, Congress wants us to. Humphrey Hawkins, if you're into this thing, full employment, not realizing the best thing the Fed can do to help the economy is not print money, which ends up disrupting things, but have a stable dollar and deal with the occasional panics. Maybe this is telling me to shut up. Let's put it away. The fact of the matter is, if the Fed just sticks to those two things, and you might want to give it something else to do, because just a stable money, keeping within a fixed range of gold, gets very boring. You come to work each day, let's call it $1,500 an ounce, just picking a number. Under a gold standard, if it goes much above 1,500, you tighten. Goes much below 1,500, you ease. You just keep it in that range. Fixed value, which means you have a vibrant economy, create more money. Stagnant economy, you don't. That gets very boring. A couple of high school students could do it each day. So what do you do with all these PhDs? Well, maybe you let them do research, even though that should be done by other agencies and universities. But, hey, let them do that to keep them occupied. Because if they have nothing to do, then they're going to look for something to do. And that's not a good thing. So, we'll let them do research. If you want to have them regulate something, do that too. And just keep them occupied. You want to process checks, what checks they're left, do that too. You want to do airplane models, let them do that. But the basic is stable money, and deal with the panics. And that's it. That's the best thing they could do.
A little into the political realm now. Do you believe political leaders truly recognize the economic effects of their decisions and or non-actions? Are they misunderstanding the situation?
I don't think some of them truly recognize what they're doing. They've been taught, for example, well, we were taught in school that spending is good. Spending stimulates the economy. In the real world, it shows, no, you do not. That manipulating currency is a good thing. No, it is not. So there's a lot of bad theory out there. And it's happened before. I mentioned the Depression. One of the reasons we got the Great Depression was that the economics profession, even though they knew, obviously, the subject of taxation, they had very little understanding of the impact of taxation on economic activity. For example, you raise tariffs, which is taxes on imports. Everyone understood that means you'd be paying more for products. What they didn't connect was not only would you pay more, it means the rest of the economy is going to be hurt, and you're going to get less economic activity. So you had in 1930, if you want to impress your cocktail friends how learned you are, you can say in 1930 in June when Hoover signed the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, which destroyed global trade, raised taxes 60% on over 1,000 products coming into this country, on everything, including olive oil, and 30 countries instantly retaliated. 30 countries had made it clear to Washington they're going to retaliate if we went forward with this. 1,000 economists signed a letter, petitioned to Hoover, saying, you sign this, this is not going to be good. Hoover ignored it, signed the bill, economy tanked, global system blew up. Those 1,000 economists, most of them didn't connect the dots that Smoot-Hawley, they all acknowledge, didn't or made the Depression worse, but they didn't realize this was a core cause of the Depression. For those of you who are into history, Alfred Marshall, great Victorian economist, Cambridge, wrote a book on economics, 850 pages. I just read this the other day, 850 pages, pointing out that not a word about taxes and the impact on the economy. So in the early 30s, as this crisis got underway, the response was raise taxes, which was the worst thing you could do. And now we're doing it again today. So they do have some understanding, but oftentimes it's just a bad theory. It's not malevolence, just bad theory. Part of it is power politics, too. Let's be blunt about it. Spending is power. Being able to allocate and appropriate money is power, which means somebody has to come to you to get the favor. That's why there's so little appetite to truly rein in spending, because it means power. It means taking resources and having control of resources.
A softball question for you. Are you giving advice to Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan? Are they taking it?
Of course, they phone me up each morning, but I'm not going to tell you that because it's supposed to be confidential. But Ryan doesn't need too much advice from me, except in just in particulars. I've had the privilege of knowing him for 20 years. When he was in his early 20s, he came to work at an organization I headed up called Empower America, which was founded by Jack Kemp, Bill Bennett, and Gene Kirkpatrick. He came there as an analyst, went on to other things. So I got to know him a little bit then, and he helped me out in my 96 campaign. And back then, he was keenly interested in economics, keenly interested in what enables people to move ahead and what blocks people's ability to get ahead. So he's the real deal. And even if you don't agree with some of the things he proposes, he's got the kind of mind, supple mind, that if you convince him something is better, he'll quickly adopt it, which is how he got Ron Wyden from Oregon to agree to sign on to his bill on helping reform entitlements because he made some changes on it. So he's really into the weeds in terms of particulars, but also never loses sight of the big picture. So on taxes, he has two rates. I have one. So I'd advise him to do one, but I'll take two. And for kind of a radical simplification, exciting simplification that he advocates. Governor Romney, one reason I think he understands that he's got a lot to learn, but he's got a 20% tax cut proposal, not as far as Ryan, but I think, again, the politics of the thing will dictate it. because if you're going to tamper with any part of the code, by golly, you better do it big or nothing will get done. So I'm encouraged. And one of the things you learn in life is things don't go in a straight line, and things don't often happen at once. And when you have an opportunity to get something done, you do it. You get a setback. Don't take your toys or throw them out of the carriage or walk off. Go back and fight. And just to reinforce it, I've sent to both Romney and Ryan, and President Obama gets a free copy, too, of my new book that I co-authored, free of charge. And the White House, President Obama's also gotten a free subscription to Forbes magazine. Hasn't done much good yet, but we try.
This questioner asks, a new poll shows Obama and Romney in a virtual tie among likely voters. How close will this election be?
Well, the truthful answer is you don't know, and you will get a better feel for it after the two conventions. One reason why Romney's negatives are high is that in the swing states, and you should thank yourself you're not a swing state, because you've been spared zillions of dollars of trash ads. But Romney's negatives are high because he's been trashed in those a lot of those critical states like Florida and Ohio. But that comes from people not knowing the man. And one thing conventions are focused on, as some analysts have pointed out, is about biography. Who are you? What are the things important to you? What is your family like? What are people who know you? What do they say about you? It's to introduce you without any filters to the American people. And that's why the acceptance speech is so important. You, straight to tens of millions of people, lay out where you see the country at, what motivates you, why are you doing this, what you think we need to do. And I think as people learn more about Romney and learn more about Paul Ryan, I think they will end up winning on Election Day, because like him or not like him, everyone knows President Obama. There's no mystery as there was 4 years ago. And so his negatives, which are also high, are very much harder to knock down than somebody you really don't know, except vague things you've seen or caught on TV. But you get to know somebody, oh, well, he's not so bad. And the same thing happened in 1980. At this point, Ronald Reagan was 6 points behind Jimmy Carter. It was seen as a neck-and-neck race right until mid-October. What happened in mid-October was you had the debate between Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. And people saw, after all, he ran California. California survived the experience. He came across very well in that debate, won it. And voters said, we don't like what Carter has done. We'll take a chance on this guy. They felt, okay, we can take a chance on him. So if Romney clears that hurdle, we can take a chance on him hurdle, he will win. And but that'll depend on the three debates and on the convention now getting underway.
Unfortunately, we've reached that point in our program where there is time for only one question. Actually, I'm going to make it a two-part for you, Mr. Forbes. First one is, if asked, would you accept any position in a Romney administration? And second, would you ever run for president again?
Any position? Maybe this would more likely come from the Obama administration, being permanent ambassador to North Korea. No. The fact of the matter is I'm an agitator, not an office seeker these days. And so I'm not running, which is good news to my kids and grandkids. They sort of heart sank. Yes, they applauded their dad going out and making his case in 96 and 2000. But they saw their inheritance go in brochures and radio ads and bumper stickers. It sort of led to mixed feelings. So no, gave it a try, didn't work. But now I'm an agitator. Well, thank you all very much.
Our thanks to Steve Forbes, Chairman and Editor-in-Chief of Forbes Media. We also thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the Internet. Today's program has been part of the Future of Work series, sponsored by Wells Fargo and Ernst & Young. I'm Skip Rhodes, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.